Get your advanced PhD in WOW from Floor and Decor. If you're a pro, you're already an expert in tile, wood, and stone. And with Floor and Decor's job site delivery, their free design services, and pro rewards that actually reward you, your business is set to grow from one client to the next. Floor and Decor isn't just a couple of aisles. It's an entire store designed to help your business boom. It's Floor and Decor.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
Apes hunt humans. That is wrong.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. The fall of the Roman Empire has been a cultural touchstone in the West for centuries. It's been used as a warning of what can happen to society that gets off track, and while lots of ink have been spilt on the topic, most famously Edward Gibbon's six-volume epic, The Fall of the Roman Empire, archaeologists have made new discoveries in the past few decades that have given us fresh insights as to why the Roman Empire deteriorated and what that decline looked like. My guest today recently earned his PhD from University of Southern California. He specialized in the fall of the Roman Empire, and he's begun putting his vast knowledge into an accessible and easy to digest podcast. His name is Patrick Wyman, and his podcast is called The Fall of Rome, and today on the show, Patrick and I discuss the theories out there as to why the Roman Empire fell, the role of the barbarians in the fall, we also talk about barbarian life, and what the fall of the empire may have looked and felt like to Roman citizens at the time. We also discuss if there are any similarities between the Roman Empire and the United States, and if we're following the same path that Rome did. It's a fascinating podcast that provides fresh and new insights on an important part of Western history. After the show's over, check out the show notes at aom.is/fallofrome, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Patrick Wyman, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much for having me on.
So you have a podcast that's come out fairly recently. I'm not sure how you discovered it originally. It's called The Fall of Rome, but I'm glad I did because it's completely fascinating. You're taking listeners through the history of the fall of the Roman Empire. I think it's an interesting topic because the fall of Rome has become this cultural touchstone in the West, and it's used as a warning for what can happen to a society as it gets off the right track. I'm curious, why do you think the fall of Rome has become such an indelible part of our cultural consciousness? Why are we always thinking about it?
Well, I think that there are a number of different dimensions to this. So I think in a historical sense, it goes back to the kind of structure of Western education in the 18th and 19th centuries and the heavy emphasis on the classics and the tendency of the educated classes in France and especially in Great Britain to see themselves as the heirs of Rome. So they were engaged in processes of very consciously drawing parallels between their own times and the Roman Empire. And over the course of a couple of centuries, that kind of worms its way into your cultural consciousness. So I think that's the first piece of it. But the second piece is that the Roman Empire is still the gold standard for imperial rule, for political control, for cultural greatness. So I also think that there was a long-running tendency to see Rome as the gold standard for what was possible with imperial rule, because culturally, I think the Roman Empire was a touchstone for the kind of educated elites and increasingly the educated middle class in the West in the 18th and the 19th centuries, because that was their educational background. They read Greek and Latin when they were going to school, and so it was natural to draw parallels between their own time and the Roman Empire. So, if you have the Roman Empire as a cultural touchstone, through its literary products, through tours of Italy, the Grand Tour, where you were going and looking at Roman monuments, it was natural to draw parallels between your own time and the Roman world. And one of those things that you had to wonder about was, okay, well, if this lasted for so long, why did it fall? Why did it crash? And I think that Edward Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, one of the great works of Western literature, kind of embedded that particular perspective, these deep ongoing questions of decline and fall. So now when we get into the 20th and the 21st centuries, and you have the rise of the Soviet Union and the rise of the rise of the United States as the two superpowers of the world, now just the one superpower, you have to start asking those questions again, because this is part of our cultural consciousness. This idea of the Roman Empire is the kind of the eternal, unending empire. So you have to ask questions about your own time and that includes, how does it end?
I think for Americans in particular, Rome is, you know, captures the imagination, because like our whole country was basically inspired by Roman governance or Roman culture. All the founders were steeped in that. They'd often call themselves like the new Cato or the new Hannibal, right? Like they were the American Hannibal.
Yeah, absolutely. That these were not just like pieces of cultural DNA that were kind of floating beneath the surface. These were intentional parallels that the founding fathers were drawing. I mean, I think especially Jefferson, because more than any other founding father, he was the most steeped in these kinds of theories of governance.
So let's talk about the different theories about why the Roman Empire fell, because there's a ton of them out there. There's tons of books about this where everyone's putting out a different theory. So what are the most common theories of why the Roman Empire fell?
Well, so they basically break down into two broad categories. I would say that the first category is the barbarians did it. This is the Rome was assassinated. This is especially common in kind of in French historiography. Then there's the other, which is that Rome was it was a creaking kind of rotten empire in the 4th and the 5th centuries, and it died a basically natural death. So both of these perspectives in some way, shape, or form have to engage with the barbarians. That did the barbarians do it, or was Rome just kind of waiting to be kind of gently nudged over the edge? I kind of tend toward a mixture of those two perspectives. I think that the Roman Empire in the 3rd, 4th, and into the 5th century was a basically functional state as long as the people who were at the center of it were competent and did their jobs well, which was the case for most of the 4th century. In the 5th century, when the people at the centers of power in both the West and the East were less competent, external forces, the barbarians, trade shocks, plague, things like that could have a much more devastating effect.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your first episode, I believe, that there's been new discoveries via archaeology or just, you know, history that have challenged these ideas that it was the barbarians or it was just the sort of decay that happened. I mean, what's changed in the past few years where historians like yourself and others are saying, well, maybe it's not those theories? I mean, what new information has been uncovered?
Well, so it's largely archaeological, and most of it has to do with a few different things. So I think first and foremost, it's with the barbarians that we have a much better understanding of the world beyond Rome's borders and how closely tied together Rome and the barbarian world were. I mean, it's not like the legionaries were sitting on the frontier staring out into a vast unknown. Like they interacted constantly with the barbarians, that Rome was heavily managed in or was heavily involved in kind of managing what went on beyond its borders, either through a combination of financial inducement, alliances, and military force, that it had the carrot and the stick. And that this engendered really close connections between those worlds. Roman traders went out there to sell goods. They brought slaves back. Barbarians served in the Roman military in increasingly large numbers. That these worlds were not in any way, shape, or form unfamiliar to each other. I think that's the biggest one. We understand how closely connected these worlds were to one another and how thin and permeable those boundaries were. The second one has to do, I would say, with the scale of the Roman economy. We understand much better now because of really intensive increased excavations and a better understanding of all things pottery. Because pottery is a proxy marker for exchange networks, that goods have to move in containers, and in the Roman world, those goods moved in amphorae. Amphorae, little fragments of those pottery shards, tend to survive really well. So we can track in really great detail the movements of goods from one place to another, and that gives us a really clear picture of the scale of the Roman economy. Like, I think we understand how much bigger it was and how much more like our own economy it was than what came before and what came after it.
Okay, so we'll get into more detail about the relationship between the Roman Empire and the barbarians, as well as the scale, the geography of the Roman Empire. But let's talk about some definitions, some basic definitions first. What exactly do we mean when we say the Roman Empire fell? Because we throw that word around quite a bit, but I think most people have a vague idea of what it means. We know the Roman Empire doesn't exist anymore, but what do we mean it fell? Like what was the process that went on?
So I was kind of remiss in answering your question about how views of these things have changed earlier, but this is the big thing. What do we mean when we talk about the fall of Rome? So it used to be that people thought in terms of a really drastic decline, and the kind of pushback against that in scholarly circles has been to treat this as a transformation, to say that instead of looking at these series of interlocking things that happened as a drastic decline and a drastic fall, because that implies a value judgment, to say that no, just things changed. I mean, I think that goes a little bit too far with it. I think that it's possible to overstate the case. I think that in material terms and in terms of quality of life in a lot of places, things really did get worse. But with that said, to come back to the idea of fall, you're talking about a lot of different things. I tend to take a broad view. And I think that, first of all, you're dealing with political transformations, where once you had a unified state stretching from the north of Britain to the Sahara, it was replaced with a patchwork of individual kingdoms. That's the first one. You have religious transformations. You have ethnic transformations, demographic transformations, rises in population in particular places, but more generally decline in population. You have the end of urbanism, of city life in large stretches of what had been the Roman Empire. So, like, the Roman world was a whole complex of different things that together made up the Roman Empire. It's not just a political thing. If you want to define it really narrowly, you can do that. But I think it's a much broader kind of thing when we're talking about the end of the Roman world, of the various structures and institutions and complexes that the Romans had built. And to me, the biggest one is economic, that the Roman world was defined by easy movement, communication, and trade in large volumes from place to place. And so to me, the end of the Roman world is the end of that particular set of systems. And the politics, while they're important, are almost secondary to that.
And so, yeah, going back to how big it is. So you said it stretched from like the Sahara to like all the way to England. That's north south. How far like east west did it go?
So all the way from the very tip of Spain in the Atlantic to the Euphrates River in the east at its greatest extent. So all the way from Iraq to Spain was part of the Roman Empire, from the Sahara in the south to Great Britain in the north and to the North Sea.
And you said that they were able to, you know, move people, goods, communicate quickly. So what did the Romans do that allowed them to do that sort of across vast spaces of geography?
So tremendous infrastructure. It's infrastructure and scale. So the Romans built exceptional ports. They built an unbelievable road system that still underpins the road system practically everywhere in Western Europe. Like if you're riding along a highway in Spain, France, Britain, Italy, chances are good that it follows basically the same route as a road the Romans laid out anywhere between 1800 and 2200 years ago. So that's the scale of the infrastructure achievement that the Romans built, but it's ports, and the other part of it is state expenditures. So the Romans, for the purposes of the army, which was the single biggest institution in the Roman world, had to move massive amounts of food, supplies, people to do that. So that created a kind of a basic network of movement of goods and people from place to place. On top of which, private traders could build their own markets. So if you have huge ships transporting massive amounts of grain from Sicily or North Africa to Rome to feed the populace, it's really easy to piggyback on top of the infrastructure that was built to do that, to move other kinds of goods and people from place to place.
And it got so big at one point they split it, right? There's the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. When did that happen and why did it happen?
So the final split came in 395 with the death of Theodosius the Great, who was the last emperor to rule the entirety of both halves of the empire. His son Arcadius took over in the east, and his son Honorius took over in the west. But the split goes back a fair ways before that too. So for most of the 4th century, aside from the Emperor Constantine, you had separate emperors in the east and the west. And when you have separate emperors in the East and the West, the split that becomes formalized in 395, you have different courts built up around each of those emperors. You have different army units, you have different institutions, each of which are looking to different poles of governance. But you also have a cultural split between the two. The East is largely Greek speaking, and the West is almost entirely Latin speaking, in addition to the kind of local languages that were bubbling beneath the surface. So you had cultural splits, but the final administrative split comes at the beginning of the 5th century.
And why did that split happen? Did it just sort of happen naturally? I mean, it just got too big and they just thought, well, okay, we'll just put some guy in charge in that one area. They were just trying to be pragmatic about it. Is that what happened?
Yeah, that's basically it. So the real beginning of the formal split goes back to the Emperor Diocletian at the end of the 3rd century, beginning of the 4th century. And Diocletian totally reorganized from top to bottom the Roman state. Like he formalized this. And he thought, okay, well, we need to have not one emperor, not even two emperors, but four emperors. So that you need to have a key emperor in the West and a key emperor in the East, and then he needs to have a junior person under him. And so when you have that kind of administrative setup from the beginning, that creates a whole set of institutions around each of those emperors. The basic idea at that point was, yeah, there's just too much for any one person to handle here. And because if you delegate power to somebody else, then they're going to rise up. They're going to try and usurp the throne. The emperors were always, 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 to the very end of the empire, more worried about a usurper than they were about any sort of potential external threat from the Persians, from any barbarian group, from whatever, because that was a threat to their basic legitimacy.
Okay, so with that threat in mind, I mean, how did the two capitals, the various emperors, how did they interact with each other? Did they get along pretty well, or were they always kind of like, I don't know about this guy. I got to get along with them because we're on the same team, but that guy could take over.
It ran the gamut, you know. You had some cases, there was always a bit of wariness about it, but you had some cases of relatively close interaction between the two and cooperation between the two. So the great irony of the Goths, massive defeat of the Emperor Valens at the Battle of Adrianople in 378 AD, this huge turning point in Roman history. An emperor dies on the battlefield, the whole Eastern Roman field army is destroyed on the battlefield. The great irony of that is that there was an army from the West that was coming to help the Emperor Valens, but he decided that he couldn't afford to take the hit to his reputation if he waited for that army. So at some points, there's real cooperation, whether you know somebody like a kind of an incompetent like Valens could take it or not. There was close cooperation, but at other points, there was almost open conflict between the two, especially if you had a usurper on one side or the other, that could engender military action from the other side. So that happened on a couple of different occasions.
And so was that the split, was that a factor that played into the fall of Rome?
Yeah, because the East was generally wealthier and its institutions were kind of better grounded. And also, just kind of by pure luck, over the course of the 5th century, the East managed to find some really competent people to help run things, where in the West, those people just never really showed up. The West was always poorer, and it was always home to more usurpation, so it was easier for pieces of the Western Empire to get kind of carved out. Also, most of the East was focused around the Mediterranean, when in the West, that kind of the orientation of the frontier provinces of places like Britain and Gaul was not naturally toward the Mediterranean. That was kind of an artificial construct that you had to keep moving through the offices of the state, large amounts of men and materiel to kind of continue to keep those places tied in. When those mechanisms started to break down a little bit, it was really easy for those provinces to kind of spin off and spin away and reorient themselves in other directions. So it was just easier for the East to keep things grounded and keep things centered. Everywhere's closer to the Mediterranean. There's more money. The cities are older and better established. And then on top of all that, you have more competent people.
So, I mean, the Eastern Empire, technically, kind of, you could say it went on into the 1400s, right? The 13th century. So, do historians consider that part of the Roman Empire? So, like, when we say the Roman Empire fell, well, part of it continued for centuries longer. So, like, what do you mean by it, the Roman Empire fell when a part of it continued?
Yeah, when we talk about fall, we're talking exclusively about the West. I mean, the what remained in the East, like the Byzantine Empire, or the Eastern Empire, whatever we want to call it, was still the superpower of the Mediterranean world. I mean, it was still the most powerful state in the Mediterranean world up until the up until the 12th or the 13th century. Up until the Crusaders sacked Constantinople in 1204, if you had to point to one individual state as being the most powerful and the most important one, it was the Eastern Empire, because it had Constantinople, but also because it had this long tradition and this long history. And they certainly considered themselves Romans, you know, to the extent that the Seljuk Turks in Anatolia, who would eventually go on to found the Ottoman Empire, they called themselves the Seljuks of Rome, that this was the reputation of that particular side of the empire, even if in the West they weren't necessarily considered to be Roman in the same way.
Interesting. So when did the fall of the empire begin, and why is that the starting point for you?
So I pick the entry of the Goths into the empire in 376. That for me is a starting point. You could go earlier, you could point to the crisis of the third century when kind of everything went to hell in a handbasket all at once for the Roman world. But I picked the entry of the Goths because at that point, the empire was more or less stable. It was run by competent people, but things changed when the Goths entered through a series of things, none of which had to be inevitable. Like you have to remember with all of this, there's a lot of chance involved, that this was the first time where you had a barbarian group having as much success as the Goths did, where they essentially forced a settlement. Before, when barbarian groups had entered the empire, they were either settled under negotiated terms, but clearly in a subordinate position, or they were defeated, driven back beyond, enslaved in large numbers. The Goths were the first group to be able to some extent, dictate the terms of their settlement, to form something like a separate power block within the empire. And it was a blueprint that would be carried out by a number of different groups after that. So I think that marks an important turning point in the relationship between the Romans and the people beyond the borders.
And then at what year do you say it ended, and why do you pick that year?
That's a harder question. For me, I pick the campaigns of Justinian in the 530s. So Justinian, a Roman, the emperor in the East. Justinian went and reconquered large portions of the Western Empire. And for me, that's an important distinction. It forced people in the West to come to terms with the fact that for the past 60, 80, 100 years before that point, they hadn't been living in the Roman Empire anymore. For a long time, people could kind of maintain the illusion that things had not really changed all that much, especially in Italy, where you had a barbarian king, sure, but that wasn't really all that much different from a world where you had a puppet emperor and barbarian generals running things. When Justinian sent Eastern Roman armies to reconquer the West, suddenly you had to come to terms with the fact that your whole mental framework was kind of off. That things really had changed, whether you were aware of that or not. That for me is a really important kind of mental turning point. But also, that's the point where the kind of Roman world system, where the easy connections between places, the easy movement of goods and people, where that started to change dramatically too. You also had a massive plague at that point that reduced populations. Justinian's wars in and of themselves caused a great deal of damage in various places. Again, large population decline. So that to me is the point where things have become so markedly different that we can talk about the end of the fall.
So let's talk about the barbarians, because you use the entry of the Goths into the empire as the starting point of the fall of Rome. And that's the common narrative, that the barbarians came in and sort of took over decaying regime. But what were the barbarians like? Because I think a lot of people, when they hear the word barbarian, they imagine like guys wearing, like eating, meat off a bone, wearing, wolf, helmets or whatever on their head. I mean, so were they sort of these brutes, or were they actually, have a very sophisticated culture?
So they had a really sophisticated culture. They had well thought out laws. There were increasingly strong social hierarchies. These were organized societies. Like, that's when I mentioned earlier the archaeology that has come to light and the sophistication of the barbarian world. A large part of that has to do with, we realize now how densely populated the barbarian world was. Like, there wasn't it's not like you crossed the border and things were deserted and you just had these like little groups of fur wearing savages hanging out there. Like, the density of settlement in the barbarian world is kind of staggering for us to think about. Like anywhere where they've done detailed field surveys and tried to figure out, okay, how many people were actually living here at a given time, the answer has always been higher than anybody expected. So this was an increasingly populated, an increasingly politically sophisticated world where over the course of the 3rd century, kind of as a result of Roman imperial weakness and into the 4th century, barbarian tribal confederations grew up beyond the boundaries of the empire. So I mentioned before how the Romans had gone about managing the world beyond their borders. And the way that they did that was to try to prevent any one king, any one tribal chieftain from becoming too powerful. So you would subsidize some, you would attack others, you would try and co-opt still others by bringing their children into the empire or offering them ranks, titles, things like that. In the 3rd century, when Roman attention was kind of focused inward, it allowed the barbarian groups beyond the borders to become more powerful than they had ever been before. It allowed them to organize in the absence of Roman attention into larger, much more powerful confederations. So this is when we first start to see groups like the Franks, the Alemanni, and above all, the Goths. This is when they appear in the sources, and they appear in a context of Roman imperial weakness and diverted attention. But they're increasingly sophisticated, you know, they're increasingly tied into the Roman world. You can find more coinage, like more Roman coinage, in the Gothic lands beyond the Danube from the 4th century than you can in the Roman provinces on the other side of the Danube in the 4th century. They've got monetary economies, large amounts of imports and exports. But to me, the really interesting thing here is the kind of increasing military integration between the barbarians and the Romans. So if you're a Roman general and you need troops, you're on the border in the 4th century, it's a lot easier to recruit barbarians, people who have traditions of military service, who are not necessarily warlike by nature, but are more socialized into that kind of violence. It's easier to recruit them and train them and have them be your long service Roman soldiers than it is to try and recruit provincials, like Roman provincials, into the army. So over the course of the 4th century and into the 5th century, the line between a barbarian group and a Roman army becomes thinner and thinner and thinner and thinner. So when you have who eventually sack Rome, right? Like at various points, all they're looking to do is get a proper Roman imperial billet. Like it's basically a Roman army that happens to be composed mostly of Goths. So the line between a barbarian people and a Roman army is kind of thin, and the Roman army adopts increasingly barbarian styles because they think they're cool. Like they want to wear barbarian style clothing. They want to have. They're in some cases there are references to tattoos. They use barbarian names because they think they sound cool. They have a particular army style of Latin that's heavily inflected with Germanic words. That the barbarians in the Roman military become increasingly hard to distinguish from one another, because to be a barbarian is to be a soldier, and to be a soldier is to be a barbarian. So the kinds of identities get really intertwined with each other.
Texas Pete is the sauce that allows you to sauce like you mean it. Each Texas Pete sauce is packed with a bold, balanced flavor. The signature tanginess is what makes it a legendary hot sauce that can be used on just about anything. You're definitely going to want to try every flavor. The original hot sauce has a famous secret blend of fermented peppers. Their hotter hot sauce is 3 times hotter than the original, and it's not for the faint of heart. They also got a flavor called Sabor by Texas Pete, adds authentic Mexican flavor, and they also have a dust dry seasoning that matches the flavor of the original hot sauce in a flavorful dry rub. But the flavor that I've been enjoying lately is the chopped sriracha sauce. It's got chili, garlic, and some tropical tangy notes. It's really good. I love putting on my eggs. Texas Pete, sauce like you mean it. Visit TexasPete.com and use the store locator to find Texas Pete products, as well as purchase sauces and get recipe inspiration. And you can use promo code PODCAST24 for 20% off at TexasPete.com. That's PODCAST24. For 20% off at TexasPete.com. Check out the Sriracha Cha Sauce. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, MANLINESS. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss.
So just to clarify, so I mean, it sounds like we say the barbarians lived outside the borders of the Roman Empire, but it sounds like, you know, if they lived in France, like the Franks or the Goths who lived in, you know, what is now Germany, like weren't those part of the Roman Empire? Wasn't those areas part of the Roman Empire geographically?
Well, so they lived beyond the borders, but the frontiers are pretty porous. You know, you had large numbers of Goths who lived within the boundaries of the Roman Empire. You had large numbers of Franks who lived within the boundaries of the Roman Empire. Even if those barbarian groups had their political leaders outside, the individual people and groups of people could and did still migrate regularly into the within the boundaries of the empire.
Gotcha. And so you're going back to those names. There's an episode where you dedicate, where you kind of create a fictional barbarian, like what his life was like and what it would have been like. And you talk about some of the names. I thought they do sound kind of cool. What were some of the names, common names of barbarians, and that maybe a Roman soldier might adopt for himself?
Oh, so there's the hypothetical Goth that I came up with, his name is Vulfila. That was a fairly common Gothic name. There's a Marcomer, Claudio for the Franks, Ricimer, Gundobad, names like that. Like in this particular kind of militarized environment, even people who weren't of barbarian descent might give their children those names, again, because I think they sounded cool. They thought that sounds like a military name. I'm going to name my child that. So in the 6th century in Italy, you have like this blue-blooded Roman aristocrat who takes on some military roles, but he gives both of his sons, who are blue-blooded Roman aristocrats like himself, Gothic names, because again, they speak to a military kind of identity, to being kind of a bad dude.
And so, I mean, it's interesting because to me that signifies that Roman culture no longer resonated with Romans as much if they weren't giving their children Roman names. I mean, so what was the culture of Rome at that time where they would want to take more influence from the barbarians instead of looking to Rome?
Well, so one of the really interesting things that happens over the course of the fifth and the sixth centuries is that you do see a pretty, in some areas more so than others, a pretty tremendous cultural transformation. So in some regions, let's say you've got an aristocrat who lives in kind of southern Gaul and what's today southern France in Aquitaine near Toulouse, right? You've got this guy, he can kind of go about his business without really feeling like anything major has changed. That he can still write letters to all of his friends. He still lives on like a super luxurious estate. He's still got a bathhouse at his villa. For people like that, things didn't really change all that much. But in other areas, if you're living in say the northern part of Gaul and what's today Belgium or part of the Netherlands, up to the border with the Rhine River, in that area you can't really pretend that things haven't changed. You've got a large amount of social instability that expresses itself through things like all of a sudden people start burying themselves with weapons. You only do that in a context where there's social instability and things like that. But what you get through large parts of the former Rome, of what had been the Roman Empire, is a more militarized society. So if you had one of these aristocrats living in northern Gaul, that guy couldn't pretend that things hadn't changed. He would need to take on more of a military identity. So you get one of the ways to think about the fall of the Roman Empire is to look at masculinity and to say that it changes from a particularly civic brand of masculinity that's focused around public service, oratory, literary skills, and to say that it was replaced with a military brand of masculinity, that to be a man, to be an important man in 6th century northern Gaul was to be a warrior in a way that to be a man in 4th century southern Gaul was to be a public figure, to be a public orator, to be a man of letters.
So Virtus took control completely.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like it was things that had previously been restricted to military contexts became more broadly dispersed throughout society. That's one of the defining transformations of the Roman world.
And what's interesting you talk about in the podcast too is that not only were the Romans being influenced by the barbarians culturally, but the barbarians as well were taking on some of these Roman cultural manifestations. Like you talk about how these barbarian kings would have Roman type villas made of logs in their kingdom wherever they lived. So, I mean, what other ways were the barbarians taking on Roman cultural status markers or social markers?
Well, so in many places, the markers that they adopt tend to come straight from the Roman military, right? So barbarians were big on belt buckles and brooches, but they were big on belt buckles and brooches that came from military contexts. So when I was talking about how it becomes increasingly difficult to discern the difference between a barbarian and a soldier, like that's one of the things is like, the use of status markers that come out of the Roman military, that like if you're a Roman general, you have a particular belt buckle that you wear. Well, those became widely dispersed among the barbarians because, you know, I want to look like a Roman general. Who doesn't? But also in kind of broader terms, for the most part, you have barbarians giving up their own languages and speaking Latin. Like there's no evidence of the Visigoths, right? The Visigoths who had entered the Roman Empire in 376, who sacked Rome in 410, who eventually settle in southern France and then in Spain. There's basically no evidence for the Visigoths speaking Gothic after they were settled within the Roman Empire. Basically none. They spoke, as far as I can tell, they spoke Latin. That's one example. Archaeologically, a bunch of these groups are just invisible. There's no sense that they completely adopted Roman material culture. And why wouldn't you? You know, like, it's nice to live in villas. It's nice to have bathhouses. Like, Roman clothes are comfortable. It's nice to eat off of like fine ceramic dishware. Olive oil tastes really good. Like, fish sauce tastes good. Wine tastes good. So, like, materially, a lot of these groups become completely assimilated. It's impossible to tell any sort of difference between them and the Roman population. They just blend in completely.
Okay, so let's talk about the Goths coming into Rome, because I think the idea that when people think, oh yeah, the Goths came in, we often imagine like they came in with their wooden shields and swords and their pelts, and they just like sacked, started killing. But the way you describe it, it was more of a mass migration into the Roman Empire. I mean, why were the Goths wanting to migrate into the Roman Empire?
Well, so there are a few things here. We have to bear in mind the closeness of the barbarian world and the Roman world. So there was a long tradition of barbarian groups who were fleeing for whatever reason to seek refuge within the Roman Empire. There was a well-established process for this called receptio. The Goths who entered in 376 did so because they were fleeing the Huns. The Huns had appeared not exactly out of nowhere. Our sources make it sound like that, but I don't think that's really the case. A nomadic steppe people had appeared kind of north of the Black Sea and had inflicted a whole bunch of defeats on a particular group of Goths. So their response is, well, the Roman world is here. We know that they're always looking for soldiers. We can fight for them as soldiers, and in return, we'll receive safety and land to settle. What's interesting here is it's not like these were unknown groups, and like all of a sudden, there's a whole bunch of like fur wearing barbarians who show up on the shores of the Danube. It's that they understood what they were asking for. The Romans understood what they were asking for, and through accident, that process went awry, and we end up with a Roman emperor dead on a battlefield. But what's really striking to me is that everybody knew what to expect from this. Everybody knew what they wanted because they were operating within the same kind of cultural reference frames for behavior.
So, I mean, it sounds like they were refugees in a way.
Yeah, basically. And I think a lot of the barbarians who entered the Roman Empire were refugees. There are a lot of groups that enter the Roman Empire that they're recorded going through one of these receptiones, and then we never hear from them again. They're just assimilated. They just blend into the background of the Roman world. Like, which, because I mentioned, it exerted a tremendous acculturating influence on all of these groups that came in. So a lot of them do enter the Roman Empire as refugees. Others, as we get later into the 5th century, more and more of them start to enter as kind of like ready-made military forces, and that changes things. That changes the relationship quite a bit.
So the initial goal then wasn't to destroy, sack Rome.
Oh God! No! They wanted to be like, they were looking for the safety that the Roman Empire provided, and in large part they wanted the material comforts that Rome provided. Like, this was an aspirational thing. Like, in migration theory, you talk about push factors and pull factors, like reasons why you want to leave and reasons why you want to go to a particular place. The Roman Empire was full of pull factors. There was greater opportunity. You know, like, if you were a talented Goth living beyond the frontier, like, you could join the Roman army and you could gain a life for yourself that would never have been possible beyond the frontier. Like, these were, like, I think, to some extent, you want to look at the barbarians entering the Roman Empire as aspirational immigrants. Like, in large part, they're looking for a better life.
So what happened? What changed where it started out this aspiration? We just want to have part of the Roman pie, to when the Goths sack Rome in the 400s.
The great irony of the Goths sack of Rome is that it was a failed negotiating tactic. That the Goths who sacked Rome were led by kind of a general, maybe a king, called Alaric. He's one of the most famous barbarians of antiquity. Alaric, or Alaric, if you want to put it that way. But so basically, he had accumulated a large military, a large army that was composed mostly of Goths, many of them the descendants of the Goths who had crossed in 376. The sack happens in 410, to give you a sense of the timing here. But basically, they're looking for a better deal from the Roman state. They're looking for, Alaric is looking for a military command. He's looking for a place for his soldiers to settle. That was a standard deal. Like, if you were a soldier and you had served for some period of time, like, you would probably get land to settle on. So Alaric is looking to secure settlement terms for his Goths. He's looking for a position for himself. His ambitions kind of grow over the course of this little rebellion, but eventually, when they get into Italy, he's threatening Rome as a way of getting leverage in his negotiations with the imperial court. Not all that dissimilar from, like, the fact that they were Goths was almost irrelevant to this. He could have been any Roman general looking for a better deal from the court. This happened pretty regularly, which shows you just how screwed up things had gotten in the Western Empire by this point. But eventually, he threatens Rome twice. He gets bought off twice. But finally, the negotiations break down again. He goes to threaten Rome, and he's like, well, I guess we just have to sack it this time. But still, by the standards of sacking a city, it was a pretty peaceful sack. What the Vandals did to Rome in the 450s was much, much, much more devastating to the city than anything the Goths did in 410. They spared the churches. It probably wasn't pleasant for the population of Rome. But all things considered, as sacks go, if you had to get sacked, Alaric and the Goths did a pretty gentle job of it.
Okay, all right. So get sacked by Alaric if you're going to get sacked. Another idea that people put out there of why the Roman Empire fell is not so much because of external enemies. Like, that was sort of like they just sort of pushed that. And the reason why they were able to fall so easily was that Romans had this moral decay within their culture and their society that made them vulnerable to these attacks. Is there any credence to that idea that Rome had disintegrated because of moral decadence?
I don't really think so. I think that if you want to look for, like, I mean, and so there are a couple of different ways to look at that. You could say that to look at the idea of moral decay. On the one hand, the idea of Edward Gibbon and other of these old school historians is that, well, Christianity caused this decline. But you can look at plenty of Christian late Roman generals and soldiers who were plenty good at their jobs. You know, that did not seem to be a defining factor there. There's also the idea that, well, you know, things had socially gotten so degenerate in terms of that caused some sort of decline. I don't think that's true. I think if you're looking for a series of internal factors, it would be A, politically speaking, the weakness of the imperial court, which grew ever more self-interested, ever less able to deal with the series of challenges that were being presented to it, which were increasingly difficult challenges over the course of the late 4th and into the 5th century. But to me, the big thing that stands out is a decreasing investment of, like, kind of local aristocrats, not like the big landowners who were sitting in the Senate in Rome, but like civic leaders, that they were increasingly less invested in taking care of their cities. That seems to me to be a kind of a big overarching change over the course of the 4th and into the 5th centuries. Like, you couldn't get people to fill city, like the city magistracies. These local prosperous people who owned large amounts of land, who had little houses in the city, who invested their money in business operations in these cities, that they grew less and less interested in putting their resources to work for the peoples in those cities. Cities declined for a variety of reasons, but I think that part of that is because people who a couple hundred years earlier would have been endowing buildings, would have been paying for games and festivals, things like that, that, like, this was part of the social compact between local elites in their cities, that breaks down. There are a whole bunch of reasons for that, but the fact of it seems to me to be a really big deal. Like, so if you're looking for internal decline and decay outside the political sphere, or like outside the sphere of high politics, I think that's where you see it, is this kind of breakdown of the ties between local aristocrats and their communities.
So, I mean, why is that? Why was that lack of civic engagement? Were they just get too concerned with money and just enjoying their lives? What happened there?
It's a good question. I think you could point to a couple of different things. A big piece of it is the rise of the administrative state. Like, so you can kind of point to the center for kind of long-term ramifications for this. But in the early empire, it was basically run as a racket between local aristocrats and a really, really small actual state. Like, the whole Roman Empire in the first, second, into the beginning of the third centuries, the whole Roman state was basically run by a few hundred bureaucrats at the center, the emperor, and then the army. And the way that you did that was because the local elites of these individual cities, like, let's say the most important people in Marseille in southern Gaul, or Toulouse, or in Carthage, were all really invested in being the most important people in those cities. And they were the ones who connected the individual people to the central state, such as it was. The average person would go their whole life without seeing a bureaucrat from the actual central government. Over the course of the 3rd century and into the 4th century, this changed. The central government of the Roman Empire became much more heavy-handed and much more involved in the day-to-day lives of the people of the empire, and they kind of cut out these local civic leaders from that process. Like, those local civic leaders could take jobs in the Roman bureaucracy, in this increasingly bureaucratic state, but that wasn't the same thing as being like a local civic leader. You know, it's the difference between saying, okay, I'm one of the 5 most important people in Carthage versus I'm an official of the Roman imperial government. It fundamentally changes the relationship between these important people and the cities that they live in. And so, you know, at first that doesn't seem like much of a difference, but fast forward 100 years, it breaks the ties that bind those communities together.
It's really interesting. So, I mean, what did the fall of Rome feel like to the people living through it? Like, did Romans understand, like, something's going on here? Like, you mentioned earlier that for some people they did notice, for other people they didn't notice. What did it feel like? Were there some people who noticed that there was something going on and that things weren't the same and things weren't going to be the same after this?
Yeah, absolutely. There were some people who did notice. There were people, especially in the 5th century, there are people who had come from like the northern parts of Gaul, who had kind of fled as refugees to the south, who wrote these excoriating treatments of what was happening back in their home regions. There were definitely people who noticed that things were different. But the flip side to that is that there were people who went out of their way to pretend that absolutely nothing was different. So, like, these hyper-literate Roman aristocrats in Gaul, like, this is the golden age of them writing letters to each other and writing these and engaging in kind of literary production. Because I think in some ways it's a way of reassuring yourself that things haven't really changed all that much, that you can kind of go on with your life without having to engage with the fact that things are changing. But even then, after a certain point, kind of had to come to grips with that. Like, the case study is a guy named Sidonius Apollinaris, who in kind of the waning days of the Roman Empire in the West had been the prefect of the city of Rome. He was from like central France in the Auvergne. But so, like, he had tried to have this kind of normal career in the imperial government, but the fact that the imperial government was disintegrating meant that he had to go back home. So he goes back home, he writes some letters, he becomes bishop of the city of Clermont, but he's like, he's still living like any other Roman aristocrat would have 100 years ago. Eventually, though, the Visigoths come and they try to take his hometown of Clermont. And at this point, Sidonius, who's a bishop, has to organize the defense of the city from people who are supposed to be allies of the central imperial government. So there's like a whole process of cognitive dissonance that he has to deal with there, where he has to realize, like, oh no, okay, things actually have changed. But still, even into the 6th century in Italy, there are aristocrats who are like basically living exactly the same way that they always have. They're reading the same books, they're living on the same estates. Social relations haven't really changed at all. They can go to work for what looks a lot like an imperial government if they want to. Like, there's a guy named Cassiodorus who wrote hundreds of letters for the Ostrogothic kings of Italy, and he's basically working just as he would have in an imperial chancery and in imperial archives 100 years before, you know. But yeah, so some people are aware of it, others aren't. I think like a merchant who was living in the city of Arles, like on the southern French coast, like right at the mouth of the Rhone, so like this huge commercial hub, like, I think that guy, if he was born in 450, would not notice any real meaningful change over the course of his life, even if he lived to be 75 or 80.
It's interesting. And I think it's interesting too, during this time, we had a class this on our podcast a while back ago, Carlin Barton, who wrote about Roman honor, the concept of Roman honor. And she makes the case that in the late part of the empire, beginning in about the 100, year 100 and going on, that Stoicism became really popular amongst the emperors and the elite. And she argues that it was because of all this rapid change that was happening within the empire. Do you agree with that sort of hypothesis, that Stoicism became sort of the way the Romans managed themselves psychologically to counter all the change that was happening around them?
Yeah, I certainly buy that up to an extent. I think up until the point where they started to buy in more to Christian theologies. Like, I think up to that point, for sure, like, you can still see large echoes of Stoicism in the writings of a guy named Symmachus, one of these, the most blue-blooded of the blue-blooded Roman senatorial aristocrats in the late 4th century. He was big into Stoicism in large part because he had to deal firsthand with these kinds of changes. So I think absolutely that hypothesis holds true then. When you get into the 5th century, I think that Stoic ideas tend to be replaced or heavily inflected with more Christian theologies. But I think that that has more to do with the fact that, like, that bishops were becoming more important civic leaders. So to that point, like, if you're going to be a bishop, well, you'd probably better do some theological reading and writing too.
Right. And I guess you could make the case too that as the fall happened and they started, this sort of military ethos began building up again amongst Romans, that they would kind of reject Stoicism and go back to that sort of primal honor, where, you know, which is the ethos of the warrior.
Yeah, absolutely. Like that guy Sidonius Apollinaris that I mentioned, right? Like this, you know, a totally civic-minded, had no interest at all in military matters, none. So like when he's organizing the defense of Clermont, like it's very clear from reading his letters that he has no idea what he's doing. Sidonius Apollinaris' son led a military contingent in a Visigothic army like 30 years after that. Like, so at that point, you can start to see that kind of transformation of this old Roman-style civic virtue into something more military, slowly but surely. You can see the process happening. Like, it's like you can trace it across generations where you have that, or where we have enough information to do it. You can see it happening. Like, it's a clear process.
All right. So, Patrick, we're going to do some Fall of the Roman Empire parallelism. I don't know if you're a fan of this, but I mean, people do that, right? So like writers and pundits, they make the comparisons between Rome and America now, because America is the new Roman Empire. You know, we have a political empire, but definitely we have a cultural empire, an economic empire. Have you, based on your approach to the fall of Rome, do you see similarities between the American empire, quote unquote, and the Roman Empire?
Yes, in the sense that we're living in an increasingly unipolar world, right, where there really is not a superpower to rival the United States, and that I think is the best analog for that the Roman Empire is the best analog for us to try and understand our own position in the world. Thinking about the Roman Empire and thinking about America in the 21st century allows us to ask questions. I think that's the great benefit of history, is that it allows us to ask educated questions about ourselves, even if you're not going to find exact parallels. By thinking really hard about the parallel, we learn something more about ourselves. So I think asking, what does a unipolar world look like where you only have one real superpower? Asking that kind of question of how did the Romans deal with that, how did they manage the world beyond their borders, allows us to learn some things about ourselves. So like the Romans didn't just put up walls and sit behind them and just, you know, wait for the barbarians to come across. The Romans were engaged in actively managing what happened beyond their borders. So I think that's one distinct parallel between the United States and the Roman world. You have to see that, like, they didn't retreat inwards. They were actively involved in trying to keep under control what was happening beyond their world.
So Patrick, this has been a great conversation, but there's a lot more we could get into, and you do that on your podcast. So where can people listen to The Fall of Rome?
My podcast, The Fall of Rome, can be found on iTunes. It can be found on Stitcher. It can be found on Google Play. Basically, any platform from which you listen to podcasts, it can be found there. I post pretty regular updates, and I'm always down to talk about it on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman. You can send me messages on Facebook, too. Search for my page there, Patrick Wyman. But I will actually have a brand new episode coming up very shortly. As soon as we're done, I'm going to sit down and record the new one.
Awesome. Well, Patrick Wyman, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
All right, thank you very much.
My guest today was Patrick Wyman. He's the host of the Fall of Rome podcast. It's available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you can listen to a podcast. Check it out. It's really great. And after the shows, check out the show notes at aom.is/fallofrome, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. Our show is edited by Creative Audio Lab here in Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you have any audio editing needs or audio production needs, check them out at creativeaudiolab.com. As always, we appreciate the continued support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Start clean with Clorox, because Clorox delivers a powerful clean every time. Because messes happen. Because... I got the charcoal mask. Great, because why would I put that on my face when I could drop it in my sink? This is what I get for multitasking. Ugh, why is charcoal so sticky?
Hello?
Hey, Janice. I am so sorry. I thought I was on mute. No, we don't need to reschedule. I'll just stay off camera. Ooh, yeah, that happens. So start clean with Clorox. Use Clorox products as directed.